Dietrich Zimmer recognized the symptoms as soon as they occurred, and even before ordering that necessary countermeasures should be taken and quantities of appropriate vaccine prepared, he considered the fact that John Rourke had outsmarted him, would evade the trap he had set because no personnel would be well enough to bring it off. Immediately, he ordered his pilot, who was beginning to experience symptoms, to land at the nearest available Eden base, where a small quantity of vaccine, prepared to his order, would be in progress of preparation, if they could land while the pilot or co-pilot was still able. Assuming they made a safe landing, in only a few hours after the vaccine's administration, Zimmer would be fit enough to travel again. The work done in New Germany 50 years ago in order to counter an outbreak of encephalitis lethargica had been so expert that use of the disease in biological warfare would be grossly impractical, except in such limited application as John Rourke had chosen as his means of overpowering the headquarters garrison. It would not even be necessary for Dietrich Zimmer to bother contacting his commander there. The use of encephalitis lethargica was so patently and unexpectedly brilliant that it could not possibly have been countered by anyone but a trained medical professional, and even at that, not in time to preclude wholesale inability for duty. Dr. John Thomas Rourke displayed true genius. Rourke had obviously disseminated the viral agent during the time he spent at the headquarters, in what had been northwestern Canada before the night of the war, visiting there at Zimmer's own invitation. Rourke would have known full well that the strain of encephalitis lethargica he utilized, the same strain which had caused the outbreak in New Germany, would take 48 hours or slightly more, depending on the health of the victim, in order to manifest itself. Once symptoms appeared, however, the disease took hold with lightning quickness. Dietrich Zimmer had only a slight worry that the double vision he was beginning to experience would be experienced by his aircrew as well and precipitate a crash. Yet, if this form in which he lived died, this body perished, Martin had strict instructions on exactly how to bring one of the waiting clones out of cryogenic sleep and program its brain with Zimmer's memories. Right down to using the last recording which Zimmer had transmitted only a short while ago. If they did not make it to the ground, he would carry on, just as he had. If someone believed in the soul, of course, then death was inevitable. Had Zimmer believed in that concept, however, his life would have been totally different. Fortunately for him, he did not. It was obvious that John Rourke did. By the time they were across the river and nearing the Nazi headquarters, which was probably one of several such facilities dotted around the globe, John had told them, it would be dark. Some of the defenders of the complex might still be able to act with limited capacity, and therefore it would be necessary for them to approach with stealth. The immediate problem was the construction of a simple rope bridge over the raging torrent sweeping through the gorge before them. The river separated the plateau snowfield and the slopes from the mountain beyond. They traveled this circuitous route because John was still wary that if they were detected too early, enough of the personnel inside the complex might be able to act so that some contingency plan or another could be carried out against Sarah's and Wolfgang's lives. So close to nearly certain success, there was no sense in taking chances. During the construction of such a bridge, an interlacing of ropes strung over an obstacle but requiring someone to string it, it was fortunate indeed to be a woman, Natalia Anastasia Temerovna thought. She could have built such a bridge as well as any man and better than most, but she didn't object to being pampered under the circumstances, being left to watch the gear on the side of the fast-running watercourse, with Annie to keep her company, while John, Paul, and Michael did the wet, cold work.
I feel like a shit just sitting here.
Don't, Annie. Men feel themselves better suited to such work. And they feel better about themselves, sparing us any involvement. It's a male bonding thing. I've always found it odd, you know, that certain things are too physically demanding for us. I remember the time that Vladimir and I posed as an American couple. It was a true education. I would go to the supermarket wearing some nice little pair of slacks and a sweater or something, and have my list and coupons and all of that. It amazed me when I watched people that a man who wouldn't think of going through a door ahead of a woman and would blanch...
Your English is beautiful.
I've just been reading a great deal in all my spare time. But a man who wouldn't think of letting a woman do anything which might be physically exerting saw nothing odd in the idea of a woman carrying two sacks of groceries while she had a baby in her arms who was kicking and wiggling and screaming.
Annie smiled and looked out over the river.
They're making progress. and they almost look like they're having fun in a weird sort of way. You were right.
Natalia was looking in the same direction. John was into the water, waist deep. Michael leaning precariously over a rock, Paul stringing rope.
They are having fun. It's very much like a group of women all cooking together or making a quilt or watching children.
Camouflage stick across his cheekbones, over the bridge of his nose, across his chest in a lightning bolt pattern, along his arms too. He would show the American policeman the true nature of war and the warrior. Show him before the fellow died what would hopefully be a lingering and miserable death. Wilhelm Doring thought of the woman, Marie Dreisling, dead in her own blood, body slumping limply from the toilet into the sink, her face white, the color drained from her along with the blood through the artery she cut in her thigh. It was all the inane creature was good for, and possibly the first sensible thing she had ever done, as well as the last. The little training Marie had been given before accompanying them on their disastrous mission to Hawaii had included close-range killing techniques. She had used such a technique on herself. Wilhelm Doring doubted she would have had the courage or the ability to use the technique, or any other, on the enemy. Excess baggage, he was glad to be rid of her, even if it meant he could never again return to the apartment. There had been nothing to do with the body, and even if there had been, her blood was everywhere, spurted all over the bathroom walls and floor and saturated along the carpet and the room beyond. And the apartment might be an academic issue at any event. This policeman, however stupid the breed, was clever. Perhaps neither of them would ever leave these mountains, and the policeman, Tim Shaw, would also be victorious. If so, then so be it. One less enemy for National Socialism, and one less man who had shamed the Reich through his ineptitudes. Perhaps there was a poetry to justice after all. All along, Wilhelm Doring had underestimated his enemy. Until now, he had believed what his training officers had told him, that Americans were soft, easily terrified, prone to defeatism, because once their pretty lives were disrupted, they would not know how to react except in panic. That had not proven true at all. It seemed that the average policeman here, certainly if a member of some elite SWAT unit, was a highly motivated fighting man. What he might lack in finesse, he made up for in energy. When Doring left the apartment, he took with him only those items which were essential equipment for combat. The knife, which was lashed in an inverted carry to his web gear over his heart, a Fairbairn Sykes pattern, had its edges sharpened to where he could whisk the blade over his arm and the hair would fly away. At his right thigh, he carried an energy pistol, the latest and best made in Eden. His rifle was the official counter-sniper weapon, the G-70S. Selective fire, firing a 5.62mm caseless armor-piercing T-56 cartridge. Additionally, he carried a weapon under the muzzle of which he thought Inspector Tim Shaw of Honolulu's tactical squad might appreciate dying. It was a Lancer copy of the Remington 870 police shotgun, the design dating from before the night of the war. It wasn't that age was catching up to him, although he suspected that he was old enough to be his adversary's father, but it seemed prudent to take a break. Shaw found a convenient niche in the rocks a few yards above the perimeter of the valley above which he walked and plunked his gear down and his body beside it. Before doing anything, he set out a device called Perimeter Guardsman. It was a low-scan microwave detection and ranging system which, when set properly, would alert him if anything anywhere near the size of a man were approaching within 200 yards. For a sniper, 200 yards was close, but the niche protected Shaw somewhat from that contingency at any event. A more modern man than himself would have taken a nourishing trail mix from his gear. Tim Shaw preferred candy, milk chocolate from New Germany. It wasn't the expensive kind sold in the exclusive shops, but the type which was found in convenience stores and supermarkets. None of that mattered, since he liked the taste of it. If the opportunity presented itself, he would like to get the name of his adversary. Why, Shaw really didn't know, except perhaps that the fellow had his. Fair was fair. He felt strangely out of touch. No radio, no pager, nothing that would facilitate contact with the outside world. He had intentionally done it that way, because contact with the outside world would be a crutch, and if he were to fall back on it, it might cost him his quarry. The day was crisp and cool, the perfect day for the out-of-doors. Shaw finished half the candy bar, then closed the foil around the remainder, saving it for later. He'd stopped at Ziggy's Deli and gotten Ziggy to vacuum pack a half dozen sandwiches for him, just in case. And this seemed like a just-in-case situation. It didn't matter which one he picked, because all the sandwiches were the same. Hot pastrami on white, which made a lot of people cringe. The pastrami would taste better on something besides white bread, everyone always told him. Shaw always shrugged it off. After a bite of his sandwich, he took a bite of the kosher pickle.
Guys who are Jew haters like these Nazis are nuts.
Not to mention all the ordinary, normal things Jewish people did, but where would the world be without real delicatessens? They approached the wall from five different directions under cover of darkness. With the sun gone, the cold was numbing and the wind more biting than it had been throughout the long day. Paul Rubinstein's left hand was on the Schmeisser's pistol grip, his right on the pistol grip of his M16. He could not see the others, his wife, his brother-in-law, and his two friends, John and Natalia. But that was basically the idea, that they come at the fortress's main gate in such a manner that if one of them were spotted, the others wouldn't be. So far, however, there had been no signs of activity within the Nazi headquarters, nor on the walls. From a distance, the structure had appeared quite modern, which it was, of course, and formidable. It was formidable to be sure, but the architecture of the place more resembled that of a castle than that of a present-day military installation. The place looked medieval, with its vaulted turrets and its rugged gray stone. But the walls looked black now. A moon periodically bathed the snowfield before it in pale blue-white light, but there were so many high clouds scudding on the wind that it was only necessary, during these periods of brightness, to drop to the nearest position of concealment and wait a moment or so, then continue on. The snowfield, under normal conditions, with a garrison capable of fighting back, would have been an ideal killing ground, barren of any true cover. But within 200 yards of the immense front gates, these an even darker black, so dark that they were like night, there had yet to be any sign of resistance. Even possessed of the knowledge of John's bio-warfare attack on the facility, Paul Rubinstein was still nervous. As he neared what he judged to be about 75 yards from the main gates, he saw Natalia running along beside the south wall, keeping so close to its blackness that she was more shadow than substance. He kept going. John and Michael would be using a plumbline firing device to launch ropes to the top of the wall, then scale the wall from opposite ends, reach the summit, and come toward the main gates. Paul Rubinstein spied his wife, moving flush along the northern stretch of the wall which flanked the gates. For the last several minutes, he had been paralleling the roadway which connected the headquarters to a single airstrip, this apparently for landing and takeoff of cargo lifters without vertical takeoff and landing capabilities. There was a landing pad atop the portion of the structure which was at the height of the mountain, this apparently for the V-stalls and helicopter traffic. The headquarters could not have been as immense as it appeared, because the gates at the mountain's base were close to 2,000 feet below the summit. John had been taken in by aircraft and had left the same way, never reaching the base of the mountain. If it were somehow sealed away from the upper level, it was possible, however remotely, that there were still operational forces at this level. That was a scary thought. He stopped some 15 feet from the gates and waited as Natalia and Annie worked their way toward him. And he waited, too, for the gates to open. John Rourke rolled over the wall and dropped into a crouch in the shadow beyond, the Crane LSX knife tight in his right fist. And John Rourke was suddenly afraid that he had somehow miscalculated and that the strain of encephalitis lethargica he had utilized had somehow taken hold more quickly, and that the vaccine which he carried with him would not save the lives of the people within, and not just the lives of his wife and Wolfgang Mann. If he had miscalculated, he would be a mass murderer. To kill in combat was one thing, but to kill this way would be beyond excuse. He started moving, listening for any sounds which might provide a clue as to the condition of the garrison. He saw nothing, no lights, and periodically he had to stop to reorient himself because the darkness was so total. When the moon shone, he stopped, concealing himself within a niche at the height of a downward descending stairwell. Beyond this wall on which he waited, there was no parade ground. In fact, there was very little open area at all. There were several structures, blockhouses, likely associated with command and control functions for entry security. There were two bomb-proof doors leading into the mountain itself, and what lay beyond these was anyone's guess. He theorized, however, that there were powerful and very fast turbo elevators toward the height of the mountain. Rourke continued on as clouds obscured the moon again. On the wall, as he'd climbed, the wind had cut through him, despite his state-of-the-art Arctic wear. But part of the sensation of cold was nerves, he knew. What was about to transpire would determine the future course of his life, and to a large degree, the lives of his son and daughter. If he could successfully rescue Sarah, and assuming that she was indeed recovering from an operation which had brought her out of a near-death coma, and if he could save Wolfgang Mann, he was sealing his own fate as surely as if he were a Japanese warrior about to commit ritual suicide. There would be no turning back from this. Wolfgang Mann was honorable, and had circumstances been different, and something between Wolfgang and Sarah even started to develop, Wolf would have come to him. The same, obviously, went for Sarah. But John Rourke was not blind to the affinity each had for the other. If Sarah's happiness would be best served by her leaving him, the thought was something he rejected, he would think about this when the time came for that decision to be made. Now, he was intent on saving the lives of two people, one of whom was a friend, one of whom was the woman he'd vowed to love forever. In exactly 72 minutes, according to the continuous fuel expenditure summary from her onboard computer, she would have to order her twin squadrons down out of their patrolling formation, which was a violation of a general order in the event of nuclear attack, or watch as her comrades and she herself started falling from the sky when vapor would no longer keep them flying. Some few fighter planes and V-Stall cargo jobs were getting airborne, but there was still no radio signal from the base, or at least none that her own equipment, or that aboard any of the other members of her squadron, could receive. She made a decision, which would only shorten her own fuel supply and not that of the others. And if she were careful and stayed out of the patrolling formation, she could more or less make up the fuel she'd expend. She started into a long, slow sweep of the tower, another practice which was severely frowned upon, although buzzing the tower was regularly done at higher speeds. Emma Shaw did not have the fuel to waste. Unlike aboard the Blackbird she'd flown in the attack on Plant 234, there was no sexy-voiced computer companion to keep her company, and she missed Gorgeous, fully intending, if she could take care of the little matter of living long enough, to wangle things so that the next time she flew a Blackbird she'd have the same program. Gorgeous was a little spineless, but okay in a pinch. As it was, however, her own eyes and warning buzzers were her only means of keeping track of what was going on in all directions around her, her only means of preventing herself from crashing into something taking off. She wanted level flight when she passed the tower, and as little speed as possible so that she might be able to at least catch some glimpse of what was going on inside. Way below the minimum altitude over the hard deck, she started making the pass. It was then that she noticed something at the far edge of the field which had been too small for her to notice from her operational altitude. A man, arms extended, in his hands flags. Semaphore signaling was still taught but rarely taken seriously past a test or two at the Naval Academy because so much of naval aviation these days was from submersible carriers and semaphores were impossible.
Oh, shit.
She slowed her approach to so close to stall speed that her palms started sweating inside her gloves. Semaphore signaling was logical under the circumstances, of course, but this was maddening, trying to remember something she hadn't studied, hadn't even thought of in more years than she wanted to count.
All right. B-O-R-N-E-N-E-M-Y-A-T-T-A-C-K-I-M-M.
And she was past him. But Emma Shaw didn't have to catch the rest of the words.
Airborne. Enemy attack imminent.
Emma Shaw pulled up her nose and started to climb. Wilhelm Doering's eyes ached from maintaining the level of concentration he had for nearly an hour, blinking only occasionally, never turning his head away from the narrow V-wedge of rock through which he knew the policeman would pass. Sooner or later, whether Inspector Tim Shaw were eating another one of his sandwiches, smoking a cigarette, or having intercourse with a tree, the man Wilhelm Doering despised on such a truly personal level would have to pass through the wedge. Unless, of course, the man gave up and turned back in the direction from which he had come. And Shaw would never do that, because Shaw wanted this meeting as much as he did, wanted their private war to come to a conclusion here in these mountains, however it might conclude. In a way which was beginning to bother Wilhelm Doering, he almost admired Shaw. The tenacity, the brutality when required, the perseverance. Shaw would have made a marvelous commando leader, because he had daring. Unfortunately for Shaw, however, the policeman overestimated his own abilities. He would never come out of this hoped-for encounter alive. Darkness was beginning to fall, the sky to the west more incredibly beautiful in its purple light than anything Wilhelm Doering had ever witnessed. This was the perfect place for death. As if death were a god who had heard his thoughts, Tim Shaw started through the V-wedge of rock into the killing ground.
Not so smart after all, my friend.
Respect for the enemy was something he had learned was a sign of weakness, and he could not afford to be weak, now or ever. As slowly, very slowly, Wilhelm Doering began to raise the sniper rifle to his shoulder, Inspector Shaw stopped at the midpoint of the V-wedge of rock. The policeman, Shaw, turned around and went back, disappearing.
No!
This could not be. There was no way in which the man could have known that he was waiting precisely there. And if Shaw had known, wouldn't Shaw have opened fire? Through the sniper rifle's nightscope, Doring could see nothing at first. Then he detected a wisp of gray in the wind.
A cigarette! A damned cigarette!
And despite his anger and frustration, Wilhelm Doring almost laughed. In the days prior to the advent of non-carcinogenic tobacco, he recalled, there had been warnings on cigarette labels proclaiming that cigarette smoke, for a variety of reasons, was hazardous to the health. Cigarette smoking had saved Inspector Tim Shaw's life for another few moments. Doring rested his rifle, rested his eyes for an instant. Soon, Inspector Shaw's cigarette would be burned down, and so would Shaw's life. When Shaw was a rookie cop about a quarter century ago, he had been amazed that even in a firearms-intensive society such as the post-war United States, where firearms ownership and practice were encouraged as much as possible, there were men and women who joined the force who had never mastered any firearm at all. But then he recalled an experience from his youth. As a scout, he made Eagle, an honor and achievement of which he was still quite proud. He was equally dumbfounded when there were boys and girls of his own age who, it seemed, had never developed any understanding of the woods. Just as shooting was a natural part of his life, so had been trekking in the woods when he was only a lad. Only with a lot of age and a little wisdom, as Shaw saw it, he had realized that one couldn't go through life expecting everybody to be motivated to learn. Timothy Shaw was a city boy and wouldn't have changed that for the world. Concrete was better than grass, fluorescence at least as fascinating as starlight. But learning was learning. Tim Shaw's father had loved the woods, taking every chance he could to get away for a weekend and spend some time in what he called the great outdoors. Although boys were always supposed to like that sort of thing, Tim Shaw preferred the city, everything from the baseball park to the beach. Yet he never resisted learning about the out-of-doors and developing an appreciation for it. He had learned, for example, that wild things were not particularly fond of the presence of man, albeit that there were fewer wild species since the night of the war. Essentially, almost exclusively, those which had been returned to the wild, nature was still abundant, especially here in the islands. Why was it, then, that the birds and insects which would normally have been active at twilight were silent tonight? Why, for example, had the deer, whose trail Shaw had been following more as something to alleviate boredom for the last half hour, suddenly veered off almost at a right angle when approaching the notch in the rocks through which Tim Shaw had just been about to walk? What if there were a man on the other side? Granted, he was becoming a little paranoid after almost a full day of this, even wondering if the Nazi had taken up the challenge and come after him. Yet, and it was the city slicker cop reacting now, he somehow knew somebody was out there, waiting. There were some experienced firemen who could tell if flames lay on the other side of a closed door without touching the door in order to see if it were hot. Touching the door was merely a confirmation of a fact already known. There were some experienced cops who could tell if, instead of fire, a man with a gun or knife and the burning passion to use it lay on the other side of a door. Tim Shaw knew little about fires, but a lot about being a cop. Or at least, he hoped so. As silently as he could, he began climbing the big old magnolia tree, hoping it would branch out close enough to the next tree so that he could work his way around the V-wedge of rock. And that, birds and insects aside, was the other thing which made him step back. The V-wedge was the only way through the area unless one kept to the trees. This, as killing grounds went, was perfect. Men lay everywhere. As they would pass a fallen guard, the man burning with fever, obviously in physical torment, many of the guards or other personnel with limbs half suspended at odd angles, one of them would always stop and administer a shot of the vaccine, then a second shot. This was sedation. Although he had not planned to do so quite so soon, John Rourke had already called in to Commander Washington, signaling the SEAL team commander and his unit to follow them. By the time John Rourke, Annie and Paul Rubenstein, Michael and Natalia reached the elevator shaft beyond the bomb-proof doors, Rourke was certain that his manufactured epidemic had not only struck, but conquered. Although it was the only means by which he could ever have gained entry to the Nazi headquarters complex, he felt badly for having used it. Bio-warfare of any kind was supremely dishonorable, even in a good cause. The elevator shafts were enormous tubes, the color of brass, once burnished, now tarnished from neglect. Up through the center of the mountain, the tubes ran, disappearing from sight above. Two elevators, both of them large enough to handle freight the size of a tank, perhaps powerful enough for that, too. There were no call buttons, but the elevator controls were apparent enough, controlled from a synth-glass-enclosed booth mounted into the living rock, accessed by two metal ladders. It was like a control station for a ski lift. Michael and Paul had already ascended the ladders, found the controllers down, injected them, and then began to inspect the controls.
I think I figured it out, John. To be on the safe side, we should leave somebody down here just in case there's no controls from above. Be a heck of a long walk down, assuming there are stairs.
You and Annie stay, Michael.
No! I want to see Mama and...
And what good will it do if we can't get your mother down? I'll bring her back to you, sweetheart. You and Michael won't get cheated, I promise you that, darling.
Annie nodded, rose up on her toes, and kissed her father's cheek.
The three of us? You and Paul and I?
Yeah, the three of us. Just like in the old days, Natalia.
Just like in the old days, John. Paul, it's the three of us!
On my way!
Paul took the ladder easily, hands on the outer supports, feet along the sides, slowing his descent, never stopping it. As he jumped the last few feet, Paul turned toward them, went to Annie, and took her in his arms.
We'll pull this off.
Michael, get us an elevator. Keep a lid on things here.
Be careful, Dad. Natalia, Paul?
Always.
The door was opening to the elevator on their right.
Third floor, ladies' lingerie.
Let's go.
There was a complete control panel, several floors blocked off by card access, it appeared, not open to conventional access by using the buttons to program.
Can you get us onto the floors requiring a key?
I don't know. Which one you want?
Try the third from the top. As best as I could judge, that was where the hospital was.
Right. Hold on. These suckers are fast, I bet.
Like in the old days, the three of us.
The idea, of course, would be to pop the guy while he lay in wait, if he lay in wait at all. As soon as Tim Shaw navigated the last limb, the trees grew so densely that moving in them was almost easy. He would have a clear view of the other side of the V-wedge and know if there were someone waiting. Just enough light still filled the sky in the west that all was not in perfect shadow yet. Popping the guy, even if he was a Nazi, was not to Tim Shaw's liking. He'd killed men in the line of duty and likely would do so again if he survived now. But he'd never walked up to somebody in cold blood and just blown the person away. Under the circumstances, however, he doubted there would be any choice. Shaw's hat was crushed and stuffed inside his multi-pocketed bullet-resistant vest, his rifle strapped across his back, muzzle down, as he prepared to make the transfer from the tree he was in to the next one, the limb looking more solid than the one he'd already navigated.
Nice and easy.
He moved his left foot onto the limb of the new tree, exerting his weight to test it. So far, so good. His arms stretched out and he found a handhold, crouched, and started to slip onto the new limb.
Oh, shit!
He fell through a series of branches, never ending, it seemed, but he knew that they would end. Twigs and leaves tore at his exposed skin and slapped him. He hit something very hard, his fall ceasing for a split second. A bullet whined past Shaw's face. He looked down, seeing only blackness, trying to judge the angle from which the shot had originated. He couldn't. This bullet grazed his left tricep. Pain consumed him, and he shook his head to clear it, knowing what he had to do if he hoped not to die. Shaw rolled out of the tree limb and let himself fall. He was able to roll, his hands hitting the ground a microsecond before, his right wrist nearly breaking. But he pushed himself right so that he'd spread the impact.
I want you to know, policeman, who it is that has taken your life.
The wind was heightening dramatically now. His left fist closed on the butt of the .45, but he realized all along that the Nazi would be looking for a play like that and be ready for it. So at the same time, he had begun moving his right hand. In his vest pocket on the right side, he had the little Smith & Wesson revolver. The Nazi stood over him now, and Shaw looked up at the biggest knife blade he'd ever seen, realizing anything that was about to cut into you looked big, even a little switchblade.
So, what's your name, motherfucker?
Tim Shaw drew the .45, knowing it was too obvious, too slow. The Nazi rearing back, kicking, the man's foot impacting with Shaw's left wrist, sending the .45 flying as Shaw's fingers went totally numb.
I had expected better, policeman.
Then he bent forward, bringing the knife down toward Tim Shaw's throat. Tim Shaw twisted the little enclosed hammer revolver in his pocket.
And how's this, buddy?
Tim Shaw's right arm sagged to the ground, no longer able to support the weight of his gun and his hand, and his eyes started closing. If the guy was still alive, things would be very bad. As Shaw's eyes finally closed because the pain was too intense to keep them open, he wiggled his toes one more time.
So far, so good.
Then he just lay his head back, listening to the murmuring voices of the trees and feeling the coolness of the night wind. Rourke, Rubenstein, and Natalia stepped from the elevator. Rourke had guessed right. This was the same floor Rourke remembered, where he had seen Sarah. Bodies lay strewn about the floor, slumped over the charge desk. While Rourke and Natalia waited at the elevator, John Rourke barely able to make himself do the sensible thing and wait, Paul found a chair, then wedged the chair in the elevator door to keep the elevator from closing. They still might require a fast means of escape.
Washington's men should be out in front in another 7 or 8 minutes.
Periodically, as they passed a body, they would check for signs of life. So far, no one had been found dead as a result of an infection with the strain of encephalitis lethargica. And John Rourke hoped that would remain the case, enemy personnel or not. Commander Washington's men had enough of the vaccine with them to cover the entire population of the garrison. Each of the personnel already vaccinated at ground level was tagged to guard against redundant injection. By the time the personnel were able to move about, heads aching, dehydrated from fever, if all went well, the Nazi headquarters complex would be in Transglobal Alliance hands, the Nazis prisoners, and this facility a much-needed base in northwestern North America, all without a shot being fired, if their luck held. But John Rourke's plan wasn't to wait for that. He would get Sarah and Wolfgang to the lower level, hold that position until the facility was entirely secured, he hoped. The elevators were located at the central portion of the floor, the rooms and corridors surrounding them. As they reached the end of one corridor, having found nothing but hospital rooms, only two of them with patients, and three nurses collapsed at their stations, they turned into the next corridor. At its far end were double doors which looked too sturdily built for an entryway to just another ordinary wing of the hospital or an operating complex. Paul was making a radio check with Michael and Annie below.
Reception's poor, but we can make each other out. No problem so far. Word from Commander Washington is that he'll be delayed another 5 minutes. Some kind of mechanical problems. Puts him here in about 12 minutes.
Not a disaster, I hope.
They reached the doors. Natalia dropped into a crouch before them, inspecting the locks at the center in minute detail.
I'd say we should pick them. It won't take more than a minute. If we use explosives, no telling what damage we'll do on the other side.
Agreed. Paul, keep in constant touch with Michael and keep an eye on the main corridor and the elevators. Natalia will shout when she's ready. While Natalia's taking care of the locks, I'll start administering injections to the personnel we found.
Rourke set off at a trot for the nearest of the stricken Nazis. Annie felt uncomfortable sitting, still wearing the BDU pants climactic necessity had forced upon her. She stood up, pacing the elevator control booth.
You're into astronomy, Michael. What's that constellation? The one in the screen showing the north view.
What constellation, sis?
That.
Annie pointed toward the upper right-hand portion of the screen, but the shape of the constellation had already changed, and the stars within it seemed to have grown.
Holy smoke, is that...
Helicopters. And Transglobal Alliance doesn't have helicopters in this theater of operation. Get on the radio and tell Paul we've got company coming in.
Annie ran to the other side of the room and picked up the handset.
Make it an ETA of about 2 minutes. They'll know there's something wrong. Shit!
Come in, Paul. There's trouble. Do you read me?
What kind of trouble, sweetheart?
Helicopter squadron coming from the north. How many, Michael?
6, I think. Yeah, six. They gotta get out of there and down the elevators.
Paul, Michael counts 6 helicopters coming in. They'll know there's something wrong. You and Natalia and Dad, get down here right away. Over.
Still working on finding Sarah and Wolf. Natalia's picking the locks. If you get a transmission out of Commander Washington's SEAL force, tell him what's going on. Have Michael check and see if he can screw up the other elevator so the one we got blocked is the only one that'll work. Let me know. Out.
You hear, Paul?
I'm on my way.
Michael was starting through the doorway and down the ladder. Annie's eyes scanned the control panels. The controls were probably redundant with those up top.
Shit!
Annie picked up the other handset and started contacting Commander Washington, but her eyes went to the north-pointing video monitor. The 6 helicopters were closing fast on the mountaintop landing pad. Natalia opened the locks.
I've got the doors, John. Paul?
Trouble. 6 choppers coming in on top have to be Nazi.
John was coming out of one of the patient rooms. Natalia shrugged her shoulders, pushed her M16 forward on its sling, and took a step back.
We can't wait. Back me up, Paul. I go, right?
Fine.
At a simple desk about 3 meters inside the doorway, a guard lay slumped over his desk. Another man was propped up against the wall, moaning in delirium. Paul crossed the foyer to the corridor beyond. There was a series of doors on either side, all of them secure.
Cells!
Natalia was already going through the desk, looking for entry cards, as John ran in from the corridor beyond. Natalia found entry cards in the center drawer of the desk, having to move the unconscious man in order to do so.
You and Paul check the cells. I'll take care of injecting these men.
She handed John the entry cards, and he nodded and was gone. Natalia shrugged out of the little day pack she wore, took a hypodermic from inside, and set to work rolling up the man's left sleeve. Paul was filling him in on the radio transmission from Michael and Annie as they entered the third cell. This one, the door locked, seemed promising. Beyond the door was what John Rourke sought, but for an instant he didn't move. Sarah lay half out of her bunk, so still that she could have been dead, a bandage across her forehead, her face pale as death. At the far edge of his peripheral vision, Rourke saw Wolfgang Mann lying perfectly flat on his back. Rourke crossed the room to his wife.
Check, Wolfgang.
The cell was about the size of 2 large bathrooms. At the center of the back wall was an enclosure which Rourke assumed housed whatever bathroom facilities there were. Other than that and the 2 cots, the cell, extremely well lit, was bare. Rourke dropped to his knees beside his wife's inert form, touching his hands to her neck and wrist. There was a pulse, but it was very faint.
Wolfgang's alive.
Sarah, too. Call Michael and Annie after you give Wolf the injection. Tell him everything's okay. We'll be starting down. Check the status on our visitors.
Right.
John Rourke paused for a second as he prepared to give his wife the injection of vaccine, and he touched his lips to her cheek. The best Annie could tell, judging from the fact that her brother was still working on the second elevator itself, and judging by the systems diagram panel, Michael's attempt to disable the second elevator wasn't working. They could always use explosives, but if they damaged the first elevator, then it would be impossible for her father, her husband, and Natalia to come back. Impossible for them to get her mother and Wolfgang Mann to safety. They were stuck. As the radio message came in from Paul, Annie said as much.
We've got 6 choppers on the landing pad up above. A communication just came in through from the landing pad demanding to know what was happening and why the personnel in the control booth and the control tower were unconscious or delirious. Over.
You try warning them away because of a medical emergency? Over.
I told them we thought it might be plague, but they either didn't buy it or didn't care. Or maybe they were just too dumb to know they were in danger. The monitor for the landing pad area got shot out. I think they're coming all the way down. And Commander Washington's people are still a couple of minutes away at least. Get down here! Over!
You and Michael get to a position to cover. I'll signal as soon as we're onto the elevator. Get us going and then get out of there and be ready to cover us. Love you. Be careful. Out.
Michael, get out of there! We gotta hurry!
Annie's right hand was poised over the elevator control, ready to bring them down the moment she got the signal. John Rourke carried his wife in his arms. Her body trembled slightly in her delirium. The vaccine, when administered in time, there should have been at least a 24-hour margin of safety remaining, would prevent any permanent damage if it behaved as it was supposed to. He hoped, he prayed, that he had not tragically miscalculated. Wolfgang Mann was slung over Paul's shoulder in a fireman's carry. Natalia sprinted ahead of them, securing the area near the elevators. Annie's voice was coming through on Paul's radio, the earpiece pulled so they could all hear.
As far as I can tell from the control panel, they've given up on trying to control your elevator and... Wait a minute. The second elevator is being activated. They can control that. Hope to God they can't override your elevator.
Tell her to be ready and then get out of there. Annie and Michael both.
We'll be in the elevator in about another 30 seconds. I'll give the signal, start us down and get out. Make sure those front gates are guarded. If whoever it is on top is smart, he'll send a couple of those choppers down to the ground level. Stay with me.
They reach the elevator, Natalia flicking the chair out from between the doors, wedging the door open with her body. John Rourke stepped inside. Paul followed him, setting Wolfgang Mann down on the floor in the corner farthest away from the other elevator shaft. John Rourke lay Sarah there too, then crouched before them. Natalia jumped into the elevator.
Bring us down and get to cover! Now, babes!
Suddenly, the access door in the elevator's roof was thrown open and back. A man in SS winter camouflage jumped through. John Rourke raised his rifle. An object was thrown down through the opening.
Masks! Now!
The elevator car was already starting to fill with what he hoped was only tear gas. Rourke popped the seals at the cheeks of the mask as first one, then another SS commando jumped down into the car. Rourke's left fist snapped outward. In the blur, Rourke was spun around and slammed into the wall by the other two SS men. Rourke spotted at least two more men, maybe three, coming down from the top of the car. Their commander had planned ahead well, ordering men onto the roof of the car, ordering them to be ready to jump if they encountered the second elevator car, then get inside and seize control. Rourke's left fist slammed forward into the gut of the man nearest him. Rourke's right knee smashed upward into the man's crotch. As the man doubled forward, Rourke's right moved in a tight uppercut to the tip of the SS man's jaw. Two more SS commandos jumped down into the car. Rourke wheeled right, bracing himself against one opponent's body as he sidekicked into the right knee, then the abdomen of one of the new arrivals. Rourke's left hand found the butt of one of the Detonic Scoremasters, and he stabbed the pistol toward the man as he thumped back the hammer. Rourke was to his feet, back to the wall, a pistol in each hand now. A man started to dive down into the cloud of white fumes filling the elevator car. Rourke reacted quicker. In seconds, the elevator car would reach the ground, and only seconds after that, the other car, in which more of the SS commandos would be waiting.
Natalia, can you take...
I can't carry Sarah and move as rapidly as you can. Paul, give me your M16.
All right.
Rourke swept Sarah up into his arms. Paul handed his rifle to Natalia and grabbed Wolfgang Mann's arms, hauling Mann, still unconscious, up into a standing position. Paul bent, catching Mann over his left shoulder, then raised to his full height. The German MP-40 submachine gun was back in Paul's right fist. Rourke stood beside the doors, Paul behind him. Natalia, one M-16 trained on the overhead, the other trained on the door.
You two run for it, and I will be right behind you.
Don't get killed on us.
Why didn't I think of that?
John Rourke went into a dead run the instant Natalia was out the doors, Paul Rubinstein right beside him. Then Michael ran toward Rourke, a pistol in his right hand.
I'll take Mom!
Annie, an M16 in her hands, dashed past, running back toward the elevators to help Natalia. Rourke handed off his wife to his son, then wheeled toward the elevators. Natalia, feet spread apart, perhaps 20 feet away from the elevator bank, fired out the last burst from the M16 in her hands. At least six men dead between her and the elevator door. Annie's M16 was opening up as Natalia drew her revolvers. Running in a headlong assault through the open blast doors were another dozen of the SS commandos. Rourke swung his HK-91 forward. Rourke's assault rifle empty, no time to change magazines, he let the weapon drop to his side on its sling and broke the two Detonics miniguns from their double shoulder rig. Kneeling beside them, his body shielding his mother, Michael raised his .44 Magnum revolver. The Nazi commandos were still coming. Rourke had no choice but to advance, take the action away from his wife. His pistols at shoulder level, firing, Rourke marched forward, killing. Slides locked back, Rourke stuffed the twin stainless Detonics miniguns into his belt, drawing the partially spent Scoremasters. From beyond the blast doors ran gas-masked Navy SEALs, led by Commander Washington.
Hold your fire! Hold your fire!
John Thomas Rourke held his fire, belting one of the pistols only. He tore the mask from his face, blinked, and looked around him. Paul stood beside him, smoke still trailing from the muzzle of his submachine gun. Wolfgang Mann still over his shoulder. Rourke looked back toward the elevator bank. Natalia leaned on Annie as the two of them walked over toward him.
It's not even a bleeder, but it hurts.
Natalia gestured toward her left thigh. Michael, cradling his mother in his arms, looked back.
Mom's gonna be okay.
John Rourke closed his eyes and prayed that his son was right. He opened his eyes, stood there, as Commander Washington SEAL personnel came swarming through the opening now, German long-range mountain patrol commandos with them. Rourke walked over to stand beside his son and his wife, then dropped to one knee. Sarah's eyelids fluttered and opened. She looked up at him.
John?
There was nothing John Rourke could say, but he bowed his head and touched his lips to her cheek. Survivalist War Mountain is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1993, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2010, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Eric Messner, Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, Ken Jackson, Michael John Casey, Dylan Lynch, Laura Quinn Anderson, Yasmin Toison, Tony Nam, M.B. Van Dorn, Ren Casey, David Coyne, Stephen Carpenter, Elizabeth Jernigan, and Mort Shelby. directed and adapted by Johann Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Brian Rogers. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for E.E. Knight's Vampire Earth and James Axler's Deathlands, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other titles in Graphic Audio.
This is Gary.
I need to hire an expert.
Expert in what?
My parents and sister. My whole family have disappeared. I think they've been abducted.
And what do you want from me?
I want to find them and rescue them, of course. I want you to help me.
I've got red one.
Confirm drop one. Confirm drop two.
There's a small heat source leaving cabin 8 heading south.
Perimeter's clear. Blue's on it. Red's going in. Resistance, neutralized. Two females found locked into cabin 8. Transmitting images. Wraith, are these the right people?
Yes. Mother and sister.
Weather's deteriorating. Give me a readout on the Hawats.
Temperature's dropping below freezing.
We found someone. Ah, damn it. He's really cold. Stiff. And not responding.
Here's the video. Is that your father?
Yes.
I need to know your munition status.
I threw everything I had short of the galley sink. I can't fight without replacements.
So the first thing to do is resupply. There's a system near here that's listed as having a major outlet for munitions at good prices.
Retina? It doesn't have the best reputation with bisonette traders.
You haven't been to Gretna before. There's a long-standing tradition of indentured labor here.
You mean slaves?
Something's going on. I didn't think there was anything docked that close to us.
That shuttle's almost touching our hull. They're evacuating. No, it's an EVA crew. In armor.
They're going to try to board. Prepare to repel boarders. Unknown number, unknown tech at this time. Emergency airlocks are supposed to be easy to exit, not enter. Damn them!
We'll just put you in holding until the other ship comes and takes you off our hands.
What kind of ship?
A ship that trades in such as you!
Good timing, Captain.
Oh, don't kill me! It's not my fault! You're all thieves anyway!
I think you need to go to sleep for a while. Attention! Station Master, Gretna Station. You are under my guns.
Stop! You can't!
No! You started this, I'm finishing it. Bring the beam up, Dannon.
Vata's War, Book 4, Command Decision, Part 1. In Graphic Audio. If you can't find that Graphic Audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different Graphic Audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.